Richard Smith. He is a principal in the nanotechnology commercialization firm Nanoverse, and he's also the co-founder of the Nanotechnology Policy Foundation and the Nanotechnology Network. You're very busy, obviously. Prior to launching these organizations, he was a senior strategist at the Institute for Alternative Futures, which is a healthcare and pharma think tank here in Washington, D.C., and was also the director of the Global Forum on Technology Forecasting at Coates and Jarrett. And prior to that, he had been a strategic planner at AT&T, Unisys, Sony, and director of planning and research administration for the Georgetown University Medical School. And he is going to talk with us about U.S. nanotechnology policy, bridging the gaps.
Thanks.
Thanks very much, Richard.
Can you hear me now? Yeah, that works. Let me just give you a little bit about what those three organizations that Scott mentioned to you are, so you'll know just a tiny bit about my background and therefore what my prejudices are and why I might try to point you in one direction rather than another. Excuse me. Nanoverse is about 2 years old now. We work with university researchers in their laboratories trying to divine what kinds of applications they have, not necessarily in the nanotech sphere, because there isn't really any low-hanging fruit in nanotechnology today for commercialization, unless you want to do some relabeling and call small things nanotechnology. But we do work with scientists on things like MEMS and microfluidic devices, et cetera, hoping to take them from the laboratory to the point of market entry, where we can make a decision about either going forward manufacturing and marketing or spend them out to larger commercial enterprises that have been in the marketplace for a while. So I'm very interested in the whole process of commercialization and bridging the gap between scientists and the marketplace, and we'll talk about that a little bit. The Nanotechnology Network was put together for the purpose of getting people in the nano realm to talk to each other, people from government, science, industry, lots of people involved in IP and all of that, because as we'll talk about in a moment, lots of people who are interested in this realm don't speak the same language, and the more we can get them talking to each other, the better. The Nanotechnology Policy Foundation we put together for the purpose of engaging the public in conversations about nanotechnology, what it means, what are the long-term societal implications. We've been talking about nanotechnology since 1959, but very few people in the public have had an opportunity to weigh in on what it means to them and what it will mean to them in the future. One thing that we seriously want to avoid is what happened with genetically modified foods. In Europe in particular, American companies went over there and weren't upfront and honest with the public about what they were doing, didn't allow the public to engage, and as a result there was a tremendous backlash that has resulted in starvation in some parts of the world, just because people weren't allowed to express their concerns and their fears, and we don't want to do the same kind of thing with nanotechnology. As I wear my commercial hat, I particularly don't want to be in a position of getting people to invest many millions of dollars in companies that will be put on hold because at some point someone decides that they haven't been told the truth about what the implications are. So we want to get everything out on the table right away and let people think and not be told that since they're scientists, they should sit down and shut up. We want people in the general public who will be impacted by nanotechnology to have the opportunity to talk about it. Okay, those tell you my prejudices. I've been involved in this now for 10 years. I will not forget the time that I picked up Unbounding the Future. I saw Gail walk in just a couple of minutes ago, and of course Christine and Eric are here. I decided on reading that book that molecular nanotechnology, molecular manufacturing, were intuitively obvious. The question was, how do you get there? How long will it take to get there? What will happen when you do get there? And I called Chris and asked her what I could do, and have been involved in doing this kind of thing ever since. Let's talk about the gaps that exist between various actors in nanotechnology. You've got inventors, and they have inventions, and you have visionaries who think about what those inventions might lead to. And you've got investors and markets and the established nanoscience community. And in between, you've got this great big gap, and it's a long way across, and it's a long way down. And what I want to talk about is some ways that we can think about closing, bridging that gap. I want to make a few pointers about science policy first. Federal government policy in the United States is all about who gets the money. It's not about what's nice and what's not. For the most part, it's not about partisan politics. It's about who gets the money to spend on what and when. R&D in America, R&D usually stands for research and development, but it's mostly research and not development. That's intentional public policy. We decided a long time ago that we don't want to have an industrial policy in the United States. We don't want to pick winners and losers, as it were. So except for CQDI, applications like you might find in the Department of Defense and DARPA, most of the money is going to go to research and not development, and that is going to have an impact on what we decide to fund, where the money goes. And it is politics. It's mostly not partisan politics. As Chris said a little while ago, there is bipartisan support for nanotechnology, but it is political. It's not political science so much as it is scientific politics. And politics is all about the language that we use to describe what it is that we're doing and why. Okay, the present issue, I want to say, is incommensurable terminology. When Chris talks about molecular manufacturing and you see the picture of the manufacturing plant that's nano-sized, scientists see one thing. Politicians see another thing. And unless we can bridge that gap, we run into problems. We talk around each other. We talk past each other. We talk through each other. Sometimes it's kind of like the Who's in Whoville, not knowing how to communicate in ways that other people can understand. I like to think of it as the Tower of Babel. Lots of important things being said by lots of people who know what they're talking about, but they talk past each other, and they don't have any common frame of reference. So we're just not talking with each other. Let me give you some examples of what I'm trying to say. The key question for inventors is, what problem can I solve? I won't say that's the only question, but that's a key question. And a key question for investors is, how much money can I make? Those are two equally important questions, and the answers that are given to those questions are nonsensical to the other side of that equation, unless you have somebody filling in the gap, or unless you teach those individuals how to fill in the gaps for each other. Investors are seen by inventors as flaky and not ready for prime time and not interested in solving real problems that have real economic benefits that can justify investment in them. Investors are seen by inventors as greedy and not willing to accept risk for anything except a sure thing. And by the way, in this investor category, from the perspective of scientists, I would include government investors, not necessarily being seen as greedy, but being seen as not interested in taking any kind of risk. That's why you see things like I used to see when I was at Georgetown Medical School, where research grants to the NIH were not proposals about what they wanted to investigate and discover and learn next year, but rather what they had investigated and discovered and learned last year, framed as a next year question. The money would then be spent not to discover those things that were described in the proposal, but rather to discover those things that would be described in next year's proposal. And the reason for this is that the people making the decisions on where to spend the money are making those decisions in large measure on what's less risky, what's going to subject them to less criticism. They want to show progress, and the way to show progress is to show success. And the least risky way to show success is to demonstrate something that's already been demonstrated. Sad but true. Now let's look at visionaries and physical scientists. For some visionaries, the key question might be, what role might technologies play 10, 20, or more years from now? Whereas for physical scientists, the key question would be, What's concrete and reliably predictable, and again, won't subject me to criticism? Looking through the eyes of one at the other, physical scientists think that visionaries are purveyors of hype, and you hear this all the time. And Chris mentioned it earlier, you don't want to overpromise. That's another way of describing hype. On the other hand, if you're a visionary, you need to describe what it is you're trying to get to, or you won't ever get there. Visionaries are seen, or rather see physical scientists as short-sighted, and in fact, that's certainly often the case, and it's by design. Now, nano-visionaries versus the established science community. On one hand, we have people saying things like, we need a focused R&D effort on molecular machine systems leading to molecular manufacturing. You heard that this morning from Chris. In fact, I took those words from her abstract for her talk this morning. And on another side, you see words like, and I'll quote, mechanical nanosystems cannot exist within the size of a few nanometers and bear the complexity that would allow them to replicate mechanically. These are very speculative, more like science fiction. I think you can probably guess who said that. That was Mike Rocco. Mike is a visionary in his own way. He's been involved in nanotechnology for more than a decade. He's survived the Clinton administration and the Bush administration. He's gotten a lot of money to be directed towards nanotechnology development. And when you hear Mike talk about the benefits of nanotechnology in the future, you will invariably hear him talk about things like solutions for healthcare, solutions for energy problems and water and pollution and things like that. And what he describes as his goals require the kind of nanotechnology that Chris and Eric have been talking about for 20 years now. But he won't frame it that way because of the political frame that he finds himself in, and what I want to do today is try to help with that just a little bit. The result of the incommensurability of terminology that's being used is that there's no money for this kind of project. Now, the Foresight Institute has been suggesting for some time, and it was originally proposed in the 21st Century Nanotechnology R&D Act, that there be a project to look at the feasibility of molecular manufacturing. And Chris put it up there as a grand challenge this morning. That amendment to the bill was defeated. There is no program right now in the United States, nor anywhere else in the world, to the best of my knowledge, to look at the feasibility of molecular manufacturing of big things. Chris mentioned battleships as a possibility there. Now, she also mentioned potatoes. Somewhat different, but nonetheless more complicated than merely nanomaterials that sit there and passively do nothing. There is no money for that kind of project, although a case could be made that if we really want to know where to dedicate our resources for the best long-term benefit, it would really be interesting to me to know, is it feasible? Is it possible to build these kinds of things? You hear Eric debating with Ralph Merkel on his side, with St. Richard Smalley, about the possibility of doing these kinds of things. And to date, nothing has come of those arguments. We certainly don't have any money looking at that problem. And I, for one, think that it would be beneficial. Why do we have this problem? The people with the money, and in the case of this kind of research, that means government, because industry is not going to fund research into something that doesn't have a payoff for, Chris said, 15 years, maybe as long as 25 years. It's only the government that would fund something like that. So the people who've been saying that assemblers are impossible for the last decade can't just turn around and say, oh, but we want to spend $5 or $10 or $20 million to answer the question that we've already answered. And as long as the discussion stays in the same frame that it currently exists in, you're not going to see a change in that. The answer is going to remain the same. All these words make me crazy. I would give credit to the artist. I have no idea who it was. I found it on the web. If it's one of yours, I apologize, and I'll pay you some percentage of the fee that I'm giving for this little chat. But it did make me think. The words might make us crazy, and playing the game might make us crazy, but we have to play the game because it is politics. We need some new words. And what I'm going to suggest comes from the work of George Lakoff at University of California at Berkeley. He's a cognitive linguist who specializes in the concepts of framing and metaphors. And what I'm going to say for the next couple of minutes is not a prescription for how to solve this incommensurability problem, but just a way of thinking about it that might twist your thoughts a bit in how to frame this conversation when we think about whether there is some way to get funding for this kind of feasibility project that's been proposed. First, let's decide if it's really important. Do we need to know if it's feasible? One answer to that question is no, we don't really need to know. We can go about science and business as usual, and ultimately we will find the answer to that question. And that's a perfectly acceptable solution. I would feel somewhat differently, as I said. I think it would be interesting to know. But the null hypothesis goes something like, if you spend, let's pick a figure, $5 million to find out whether molecular manufacturing is feasible, that $5 million is taken away from some other science project. That other science project might be described as having more near-term benefit to more people, and that's the discussion that you end up in. So first decide, is it really important, and frame it in such a way that you understand, whether you can communicate or not, at least understand the value of that proposition. Why is it important? What's it worth to know the answer to the question? Second, find targets that are multidisciplinary. And I suggest this for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is that when you have projects that involve people from chemistry and physics and material science and social science, everyone is forced to speak more or less English because the jargon that each discipline has isn't understandable by the people from other disciplines. So when everybody has to speak English, at least you're in the same area of thought and can communicate a little bit better than it used to be. It is getting much better than it was, but we still have a ways to go. Third, find opportunities that are realizable in a fundable time frame. If you ask the U.S. government to study something that isn't going to have an answer for 25 years, it better be something that has to do with a battleship, because they're not going to invest in applied research that has a time frame further off than that. So my suggestion here is think about some project that has a nearer term benefit for which you need this capability, or at least as part of a longer term plan, you need this capability. Fourth, pick a frame and metaphors that work for you and the target audience. If you're not familiar with the terms frame and metaphor, please go on the web, look up Lakoff, L-A-K-O-F-F. He and Johnson have written a number of books about how we think, what kinds of thought processes allow us to communicate with each other and even think by ourselves. The one centaur of that is that we cannot analyze everything every time we see it. We have to have developed some shorthand for what's going on in the world, and that constitutes the frames of our thinking, and the metaphors are those representational things that let us think about what fits in those frames. For example, an elephant automatically engenders thoughts of things like big floppy ears and long trunks and large feet and eating peanuts and acting like a water hose. You don't have to think those things one at a time when you see an elephant. They automatically come to mind. So think of a frame and the metaphors within that frame that you're comfortable with, that you understand, and that you can communicate, and hopefully that your audience will also understand. And think of becoming a symbolic analyst instead of a power player. When you have an argument with the guy that's got the hammer, you're going to lose. Now, in this case, I mean hammer in two different ways. The metaphor of a hammer as being the way to drive the nail, to win the argument, the person with the powerful instrument, but also the hammer Tom DeLay. If you want something out of this Congress, and it's opposed by Tom DeLay, who is the majority leader in the House of Representatives, If he doesn't want it, you're not going to get it. So trying to argue a point to get a bill through Congress when it's opposed by the person with the power, not going to be successful, not worth your time. It's much better to form the argument in a way that's acceptable to the person with the hammer. The term symbolic analyst I take from Robert Reich, the former Secretary of Labor, who wrote a book called The Work of Nations. And in it, he suggests that because of the kinds of things that we talk about at this conference, eliminating manual jobs of all sorts, the only jobs that are going to be available to us in the future are as symbolic analysts, and that includes people and functions like actors and artists, but it also includes people who are writing proposals for federal grants and trying to make points with politicians and investors. Now, getting back to the representational question of whether we should do feasibility studies on molecular assemblers, decide whether this is really the goal that you have in mind. Some people think it is, because since ultimately there will be one, that's a logical imperative. Should we do it sooner rather than later? Find a frame that allows commensurable terminology. Find terms that fit that frame. And find a sponsor with a common worldview. That is, a desire to solve problems as opposed to a desire to make money or to solve basic research questions, etc. Chris talked about the potential downsides of molecular nanotechnology, things that could be negative, things like overzealous surveillance, things like offensive military weapons. If that's the way that you think, if you're so interested in developing the technology that you're willing to spend your time with folks who are looking for that kind of answer, then you have the possibility of coming to a common end result with a potential sponsor. I agree with Chris. I would rather have it come from people who are interested in more benign uses, particularly medical uses, solving energy problems, eliminating the reliance on fossil fuels, figuring out ways to provide water for people around the world who either don't have it now or won't very soon. And there are people that will fit into those differing categories. It doesn't matter whether it's a Republican or a Democratic administration. There are people involved in government in handing out funds who will be interested in the same worldview as yours. You just need to identify them. An example that I think is easy for us to think about is protecting the environment. That's a frame that I think most of the people in this room can understand and approve of, and there are certainly lots of people in government who care about this issue. It frames the problem to be solved as something, again, that's desirable. The metaphor is the environment is a delicate shelter, and it's something that needs to be protected in the first place, and the damage that we've already done needs to be rectified. It permits terminology like save and protect and preserve, good kinds of things, things that people can be supportive of, instead of terminology like build self-replicating machines that, like it or not, makes people think about the prey scenario, the gray goose scenario, all of those things that are not at all likely, but nonetheless very easy to imagine. It allows a focus that's benign and not argumentative, and I don't mean that to be critical of the people who've been engaged in the conversation about whether there are sticky large fingers and things like that. But when we're talking about solving the problems that are facing mankind, that's a playing field, to use a different metaphor, that I think is more conducive to getting what I think it is we want. It requires hard science and scientific terminology because you can't write a proposal that's all about squishy, feel good, protect the environment, save the whales kinds of things and be successful. But you can at least project the basic idea that you're trying to present as something that has benefits that aren't just mechanical, as it were. It lets the assembler become a tool towards a solution instead of being an end in itself. And I really appreciated what Chris was saying this morning. I use the term disassembler. She was using a different term, and I'm having a senior moment. I forget the term that she used. Maybe someone will remind me of it. But the whole concept of disassembling the pollution that's already out there and using carbon as a manufacturing raw material, I think, is molecular separation. I'm not sure that was it, but it's all certainly very close to it. Something like that as a proposal to the Environmental Protection Agency. I don't know if Barbara Karn is still here, but that kind of proposal might be very interesting and very fundable. And it allows for a quadruple win, that is, science wins because we learn new things. The government wins because we have a success that bureaucrats can point at and say, see what I did for you, please reelect me. Industry wins because there is certainly money to be made in doing things like taking pollution out of the air because you're selling the machines that take the pollution. And people win because it's something that's good for all of us. I expect to be around for a while longer, and I would like to have clean water and fresh air. So if we take this example of the environment as one out of many, you can choose lots of frames and lots of metaphors, but if you take the solution to problems that all of us face, then I think that we all have a better chance of succeeding in what it is we want to do. And I don't mean for the environment to cover up the important words that we're discussing and the important concepts, but if you take those things that you want to do and wrap them in a frame that's acceptable and easy for people to understand and deal with and support, I think we end up being better off. And as I said, science policy is really science politics. And if you don't think about the words you use, you're going to lose. We've got an election coming up in 10 days. People are understanding more than usual that what you say and what you do is important, and just being right is not necessarily sufficient. 10 days from now, something like 60 million people in the United States are going to be absolutely sure that they're right, and they will have lost. So if your objective is to do things with nanotechnology and molecular manufacturing and solving the world's problems, I suggest that it's more important to think about solving problems and doing it in a way that the people with the hammer and the people with the money can support you rather than just being right. That's all I have. This is how you can contact me. Appreciate your time.
We have time for just one question right here.
I was wondering.
There's Eric.
The government, they publish these solicitations, and they want specific science done for specific reasons,
yep,
for specific applications. So what do you do when you come up with something outside of their vision and you're looking to, you know, get funded outside of that picture that you're not fitting in, that box you're not fitting in? Is there any avenue available?
Yeah. That's an excellent question. I would submit that if you're responding to an RFP or a broad agency announcement where they have some specific problem that they want to solve and they're asking people to solve it in a fairly particular way, if you were not a contributor to the wording in that RFP or that BAA, you've got a very low probability of winning that procurement, getting that money, getting that financial support. What we're talking about here is a very long-term play. Where if you need money today to solve this kind of problem, you're SOL. You're certainly not going to get it from the federal government. I suspect you're not going to get it from industry. If you've got you know, friends, families, and fools that'll support you. That's terrific. But if you're responding to an RFP, if you're responding to a BAA, if you're responding to something that's been written by someone else, they're going to get it. You're not. What that suggests to me is that you need to start working that ground. The Japanese have a term for that. It's either nemawashi or tataki dai. But working the ground, to use the gardening metaphor, well in advance, so that the people who write those requirements, the people who are going to be evaluating the proposals, already know your point of view, and they build that into the framework of that requirement. And that's how you solve that problem. But it's a long-term solution. It's not a short-term solution. I just got an email 2 days ago from the Foresight Institute about a National Science Foundation program on the societal implications of nanotechnology, creating a center to look at those kinds of things. And the suggestion in the email was, jump on this right away. Well, the proposals on that are due November 10th. Anyone who's not been playing in that for 6 or 8 months or a year or longer probably doesn't have much of an opportunity to influence the selection process or to be a winning bidder on that kind of thing. You can't win that one, so go after the one that's 2 years down the road and try to have an influence on that.
We're actually going to take one additional question from Dr. Drexler in the back.
Oh.
Get ready. I guess I get some one or two special privileges here. I very much enjoyed your talk. It addresses points that I think are central, should be taken to heart. I think that the community very much needs to rethink issues of framing and description and goals.
I hear a butt coming.
Actually not a question, but some comments, and if you have some comments on the comments, those sure. would be great. I've been very concerned with, in fact, these issues and trying to do some of that repositioning. One element which I think is very important is you pointed to self-replicating machines as something scary that perhaps should not be focused. We should be talking about something else. There's a very deep and powerful reason why we should be talking about something else. Self-replicating machines are not necessary for advanced nanotechnology. They are not necessary for molecular manufacturing. They are an inefficient way of accomplishing any goal you care to name. This is a realization that has been emerging over recent years. Part of the problem is that the label self-replicating machines has been applied too broadly. The meaning needs to be narrowed, and once you give it its appropriate definition, you realize that they are not necessary. It is a giant red herring sitting stinking on top of the whole field.
Great metaphor.
Yeah. So, interestingly, our opponents in this struggle for position in the research and development world insist on saying, no, it's really about self-replicating machines. If you look at my exchange with Richard Smalley last December in the Chemical and Engineering News, you find that I say, you've been misrepresenting the work in this area. It's not about moving things, picking up individual atoms and putting them down with fat, sticky fingers. It's about molecular manufacturing. And he comes back and with a bunch of questions, and I then explain that this is about molecular manufacturing. I use the word nanobot exactly once in saying that they play no role in this picture of desktop manufacturing. His response is, it's about nanobots, it's all nanobots, and nanobots are impossible, and they're scary monster things, and they're Drexler's dream. So our opponents are trying to make sure that it's all about that molecular manufacturing is equated with self-replicating machines. Self-replicating machines are equated with gray goo. Gray goo is equated actually with something that is even scarier than anything anyone has discussed. If you look at other things Smalley has said, he says they will naturally be intelligent and organized, and it's some very strange things in his Scientific American article in 2001. Could I ask you to back up to the Rocco quote also? So one thing is drop self-replicating machines.
Oh, okay.
Another one is, given that the term nanotechnology has been redefined, this is the Rocco quote way back early in the talk where you were comparing the two different two-column sequence.
There we go.
The term nanotechnology has been redefined. Clearly, molecular manufacturing fits within nanotechnology, but nanotechnology now means materials, it means all the things that we've heard discussed. I think that backing off from that term is a valuable thing to do. Consistently using much more specific terms that say this is a distinct discipline, that just because someone is an expert in one of the many, many, many branches of nanotechnology doesn't mean that they know anything at all about molecular machine systems or about molecular manufacturing, that many of these people it's simply outside their area of expertise, and that's an important piece of positioning and reframing. So an element of what we've seen here, we have the two columns in your presentation, which I think does an excellent job of presenting how things have been framed. We're on the visionary column, and the other side says we're the scientists. Well, an earlier slide in that sequence talked about physical science and things being reliably predictable. The argument that's made in nanosystems is that the conclusion that these systems can be made to work is, in fact, reliably predictable, and it's based on physics. The book is an exercise in applied physics. It's not, hand-waving vision, something, something, something. Gee, maybe if science turns out differently from what we see now, things will happen. It's a work of applied physics. And if you sit down and analyze it, you find that it seems to hang together. And I think the best evidence for that is that the people who are our opponents pretend it doesn't exist. They don't say, here's where it goes off the rail, here's where it's wrong, here's where there's a gap in the argument. They pretend it isn't there at all. So they consistently attack straw men. I mentioned, Smalley and his nanobots and fat sticky fingers and all this nonsense. But you see an example right here in this quote. Mechanical nanosystems cannot exist within the size of a few nanometers and bear the complexity that would allow them to replicate mechanically. See, again, it's about tiny replicators, which is a totally obsolete idea. These are very speculative, more like science fiction. Now, that's intended to read as a criticism of what Foresight is interested in. But if you see what it's saying that you can't build a self-replicating machine, which is, again, not our interest, within the size of a few nanometers. Well, no one has ever proposed that that's possible. He's attacking the straw man. He's saying something that's true, but he's positioning it as a description of what we're proposing and thereby purporting to attack it. So I think a key point, your discussion of this had implicit in it the idea that there has been a scientific debate and there's a scientific disagreement. If you go through and look in some detail at what has been said, you find that the critics of this have consistently failed to talk about what's actually proposed. What we have is not a scientific discussion, but a process in which one side has published refereed papers and books that have physical analysis, and the other side has engaged in, let us say, a dialogue which reflects either a state of being deeply misinformed or a willingness to say things that are misleading. So there has not been a scientific discussion. There has not been a single workshop under the aegis of the NNI in which anyone knowledgeable about molecular manufacturing was invited to discuss, to present, and to be criticized in open discussion. And I think that's a tragedy. So that's background to, again, I think that what you present is an accurate picture of how the world looks. I think that the directions you're saying we need to take the discussion are right on target. And built into that framework that you're presenting is some of this background, which is very different from what I think is widely perceived. So thank you very much for your talk. And
thank you, Eric. I would just very briefly comment that the people who feel differently about this from the way most of the people in this room feel have succeeded in framing the conversation in terms that are favorable to their position. And the metaphor that they've created, the framework within they have established this, is war. They are the opponents, or in their case, you are the opponent. We have this battle of ideas. It's all a competition for ideas as framed by them, and they're the ones in the more powerful position. I think that underscores my suggestion that we think about a way to reframe the entire conversation so it's not us against them, this warfare, this battle, these weapons of ideas that we're using. But think of a framework that that doesn't allow them to take this superior, higher versus lower kind of position, evens the playing field to stay on the battle, sports kind of warfare metaphor. And I would just suggest that at some point in the relatively near future, give a call to George Lakoff or someone else who is skilled at this idea of framing thoughts so that you can have more influence over people who might otherwise be adversarial, and just sit down in a room and discuss how perhaps to reframe the entire conversation so they don't have this built-in advantage that they've been working on for the last 10 years. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.